is Tuesday, February 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. Special Counsel reveals new charges in the Russia probe. Pro-government forces escalate their attacks on the Damascus suburb of eastern Ghouta, and engineers and technologists are honored at the annual Oscars in Los Angeles. It's all ahead. The special counsel probing Russian interference in the U.S. 2016 presidential election has unveiled charges against a lawyer for making false statements. The Office of Special Counsel Robert Mueller has accused attorney Alex van der Zwaan of knowingly making materially false, fictitious, and fraudulent statements to investigators about a Ukraine-related case. Last week, Mueller indicted 13 Russian nationals and three Russian entities with conducting an illegal information warfare campaign to help disrupt the 2016 election to help President Donald Trump win. VOA's Ken Breitemeyer is writing about this case.
This all relates to the Russia probe into the Russian meddling in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. This is a tangent. It's related to the charges against Paul Manafort, who is a former Trump campaign manager, and his deputy, a man named Rick Gates. They were charged in connection with ahead of the election of Trump with money laundering violations linked to their lobbying efforts in Ukraine. Now, in this new case, van der Zwaan is accused of lying to federal investigators about his contacts with Gates and an unnamed person. Under U.S. law, this is called a criminal information, was filed last week, and van der Zwaan is expected to plead guilty today, Tuesday, in a Washington court later in the day.
And van der Zwaan apparently has a family connection to a Russian businessman.
That's right. He's the son-in-law of a Russian billionaire named German Khan. This lawyer worked in the London office of a prominent U.S. law firm named Skadden Arps. And they were hired to put together a report in 2012 about the trial of former Ukrainian Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko. That was a controversial trial at the time. A lot of Western interests assumed it was politically charged, instigated by former Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych. Tymoshenko was convicted of embezzlement and abuse of power and imprisoned. But by 2014, as Yanukovych was toppled, Tymoshenko was cleared of the charges, and she remains an activist in Ukraine today.
And as this case goes on, over the weekend there were reports, and I don't think anything's emerged yet, but that there might be, I guess, additional charges some sort of an agreement with Rick Gates, who is this deputy to Paul Manafort.
Robert Mueller's office has certainly been talking to Gates and his attorneys. No change in his status at this point, though. So the Mueller investigation, despite the fact that Trump's lawyers have frequently said that it would end soon, obviously is not ending, and goes on.
VOA's Ken Breitemeyer. Well, meanwhile, President Trump waged a new attack Tuesday on the notion that Russian interference tipped the 2016 presidential election in his favor, quoting former President Barack Obama as saying shortly before the vote that there was no evidence anyone could rig the outcome. The U.S. leader contended in a Twitter comment that Obama failed to act against Russian meddling because he thought Trump's opponent, Democrat Hillary Clinton, was going to win, and he didn't want to rock the boat. He added, "When I easily won the Electoral College, the whole game changed, and the Russian excuse became the narrative of the Dems." Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what is trending?
Hi, Sarah.
What isn't trending?
Precisely. No shortage of news these days. What is trending right now is something that we've seen before, sadly. It's the hashtag never again. Now, this is referring, at least in this case, to the shooting last week at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School down in Parkland, Florida, that killed 14 students and three teachers. We have seen this before, too many times before. It seems to be sort of the handy hashtag that people draw out. There's a shooting at a school, you know, whoop, out comes hashtag never again. There's a shooting at a nightclub in Orlando. Whoop, here we have never again. Shooting in Las Vegas, 58 people dead, never again. It's always sort of fraught with just sort of discussion, I'll say politely, discussion that doesn't ever really seem to get anywhere. I mean, people saying, you know, thoughts and prayers to, you know, for all the victims, and other people saying, stuff your thoughts and prayers. We don't need that. We need action. And people saying, you're trying to take my guns away. It just kind of melts down into a nothing. And then a couple of months later, whoop, we have, you know, yet again, never again. Now, it is trending right now, but it does seem to be different. And I've been reading through a lot of these. A lot of these aren't adults in many cases talking. These are young people. These are high school students. David Hogg, who is a student at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. We, the activists, witnesses and real leaders, employ the real Donald Trump, Marco Rubio, and Governor Scott, who's the governor of Florida, to be at our town hall on Wednesday, because we don't need to listen. It's the politicians that must listen. Here's a picture of Brendan Abzug. He and about 100 other students from that school went to Tallahassee, which is the state capital, and they went lobbying lawmakers there to do something. Here he is meeting with, I don't know what member of the Florida State Legislature he's meeting with here. Actually, he's meeting with several of them. Here is Lawrence Tribe. Lawrence Tribe, a famous attorney and scholar up in New York City. Never again. It was one of the most inspiring movements I've ever seen in the immediate wake of mass slaughter. It deserves every thinking, feeling person's active engagement. I'm not going to say this is different because, you know, I hate to say this, but there was a school shooting again today in Ohio. One seventh grader is dead. No one else is hurt. So never again, obviously, is an expression. But it does seem to be this time maybe a little bit different in that the young people, you know, in this case, high school students, really seem to be sort of using it to talk amongst themselves and to talk to adults.
And they're doing this as the funerals are going on.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's a very stressful time.
Yeah. All right. Thanks very much, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The CEO of Oxfam reveals 26 new cases of sexual misconduct. The Rwandan army uses live ammunition on Congolese refugee protests. UNICEF says Pakistan is the most dangerous country for newborns. And ex-Peruvian President Fujimori is ordered to stand trial for killings in 1992. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
When NASA's Voyager 2 visited Neptune in 1989, scientists noticed immense dark storms swirling in its atmosphere. Since then, only the Hubble Space Telescope has had the ability to spot and track these mysterious storms. Hubble found a pair of these dark storms in the mid-1990s and then noticed they had disappeared. The latest storm to be observed first appeared in 2015, but scientists have noticed that it, too, is shrinking out of existence. It's the first time Hubble has photographed one of these storms as it dies. Some liken Neptune storms to Jupiter's Great Red Spot. But while the giant planet's huge swirling storm system has been observed for hundreds of years, scientists found Neptune storms only last a couple of years. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, tiny pacemakers could be game changers for heart patients. We'll have a report. A Syrian war monitor says pro-government strikes Tuesday in the rebel-held Damascus suburb of eastern Ghouta have killed at least 45 people, continuing an escalation of violence following the deadliest day in the besieged area since 2015. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said Monday's airstrikes and shelling killed around 100 people. Retaliatory rebel shelling of Damascus was blamed for one death on Tuesday. Eastern Ghouta is the last main rebel stronghold near the Syrian capital, and the jump in violence there has drawn international concern. Meanwhile, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov dismissed calls within the UN Security Council to halt the offensive and allow in humanitarian aid. The problem, he said, is the presence of Jabhat al-Nusra militants deemed terrorists by the same Security Council. Turkey has warned Syria not to enter the northwest Afrin region on the side of YPG Kurdish fighters. Stephen Zunas, political science professor and chair of Middle East Studies at the University of San Francisco, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the operation in eastern Ghouta appears to be the final assault to retake it, although he doesn't expect it to be easy.
Given how entrenched the rebels are and that this is an area that has long been in opposition to the government, there is likely to be fierce resistance and large numbers of casualties as a result. The Syrian government, of course, has made very little distinction between military and civilian targets when they've attempted to retake areas. And while we'll definitely see a tragic increase in the already high level of killing, this is not going to be something that is going to be over in a matter of days or weeks. Indeed, the carnage could continue for many months.
This area has been besieged now for nearly 5 years. Are these hardened rebels that are up against government forces, and will it be a tough fight?
It will be. In many ways, we're going to see a situation similar to Aleppo, unfortunately, where the government forces certainly had the upper hand in terms of weaponry, but they'll have to retake the area block by block.
Is it really the government strategy to take over this district or just to pound it into submission?
Certainly their long-term goal is retake control of the entire country, but they want to do so with minimal casualties. I mean, already the Syrian armed forces has lost many tens of thousands of fighters. That's why they've ended up relying on Hezbollah, other Iranian-backed militia, not to mention, of course, Russian air power. The question is how long it will take and how many more people will die.
At the same time, Turkey is warning Damascus that it will confront its forces if they enter northwest Afrin to help the Kurdish YPG militia, which the Turks have intervened to fight. Is this going to possibly widen the war, and why would they send that warning?
This does set up the very real possibility of a direct conflict between the armed forces of Syria and Turkey.
Well, Syria's army, weakened by years of conflict, what would they hope to gain in confronting Turkey?
Syria has a right to reclaim their territory, given that Turkey is violating their sovereignty by moving their forces into Syria. Given the array of forces that are against them, it would seem a questionable tactic to set up yet another front.
That's Stephen Zunas of the University of San Francisco. Turkey launched its offensive last month against the Kurds, viewing them as a security threat. Well, in medical news, some new tiny pacemakers are making headway around the world. One type is keeping 50,000 people's hearts beating in 40 countries. Studies show these small pacemakers are safe. And as VOA's Carol Pearson reports, doctors expect the technology will help more heart patients over time.
A healthy heart has its own pacemaker that establishes its rhythm. But some people, like Mary Lou Trejo, need the help of an artificial pacemaker.
My heart does not beat regularly. It skips beats. And sometimes it's normal, and then all of a sudden it just goes out of rhythm.
At Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, Trejo became one of the first patients in the United States to have a pacemaker that's only 24 millimeters long implanted in her heart. This device is one-tenth the size of traditional pacemakers. Most pacemakers rely on batteries placed under the skin. They use wire leads with electrodes on one end that are threaded through blood vessels to connect to the heart. Dr. Ralph Augustini at Ohio State says this tiny pacemaker simplifies that.
The electrodes are part of the can, and therefore it eliminates the lead.
Augustini implanted Trejo's pacemaker as part of a clinical trial in 2014. He threaded the entire device through an artery in her leg up to the heart. Cardiologist John Hummel has studied the effectiveness of this new generation of pacemakers.
We don't leave any wires behind, and the pacemaker, the battery, the wire is all just a tiny little piece of metal sitting down in the heart.
There's no surgery involved, so the entire process is safer, according to studies on the microbrand which Trejo had implanted, and another type made by St. Jude Medical. Dr. Richard Wechter has implanted the Micra in patients at the University of Missouri Hospital.
The complication rates in general for a leadless pacemaker to date have been about half what a traditional percutaneous pacemaker would have.
The battery on this pacemaker can last for 14 years. After that, doctors can implant another one into the same chamber of the heart and repeat it a third time if needed. Doctors have called these devices revolutionary. As for Mary Lou Trejo, 4 years after her surgery, her doctors say she is doing just fine. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC, and our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. Hollywood is gearing up for the Academy Awards, the annual movie honors that will be presented on Sunday, March 4th. As Mike O'Sullivan reports, the movie awards season is well underway. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, which hands out the accolades known as the Oscars, has honored the engineers and technologists who helped to make movie magic.
The first Oscars of the season have already been awarded. Among the recipients, the creator of a visual effects system called Houdini, widely used in Hollywood to create the illusion of blowing things up. Kim Davidson accepted an Oscar on behalf of Side Effects Software.
We live vicariously through the artist, so from a super, whether it's a superhero movie or Thor Ragnarok, where San Andreas Fault, all those movies, it's just like we go, wow, they did that with Houdini, that's amazing, we love you guys.
Was also used in this year's Oscar-nominated film, The Shape of Water. The software's developer, Mark Aland, also took home an Oscar, not for the film, but for the system.
It's a little bit surreal because I'm not an actor, and yet I'm getting a statue from the Academy. It's very, very weird.
Breeze included developers of software rigging systems that create skeletal grids used to animate the movements of characters. They were among dozens of people from visual effects or production companies to receive Academy certificates or plaques. Awardee Hans Repkema said his software, a digital system from the company Rhythm and Hues, was used in
The Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, Life of Pi, Night at the Museum, Alvin and the Chipmunks, Golden Compass, many, many movies over the years.
Veteran Jonathan Erland received an Oscar called the Gordon E. Sawyer Award for his technological contributions to the industry. He worked on the original Star Wars movie in 1977 and has worked with changing film technologies since then. Actor Patrick Stewart hosted the ceremony. A veteran of science fiction film and television, he said he is
very much aware of how important it was and how television programs like Star Trek and the subsequent movies could not have been made without it. I, however, feel a little uncomfortable to have to admit that I have absolutely no idea how it works.
Neither do viewers, who nevertheless enjoy the results of the complex technology behind modern movie magic. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
All that wizardry going into making movies. Well, that is our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is committed to supporting Afghanistan's government in its efforts to achieve peace, security, and prosperity for their country. As part of this support, we are working to undermine the Taliban and the Haqqani Network terrorist organizations. One of the best ways to hinder any terrorist group's activities is to disrupt the activities of its high-level operatives. To this end, the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, designated under Executive Order 13224 four members of the Taliban and two from the Haqqani Network. Abdul Samad Sani is involved in financing the Taliban and procuring supplies for them. In recent years, he has on numerous occasions raised or collected funds for the Taliban, purchased supplies and ammunition for Taliban commanders and fighters engaged in combat in Afghanistan, and appointed special representatives to serve as Taliban fundraisers abroad. Abdul Qadir Bashir Abdul Basir, a member of the Taliban Finance Commission, has provided Taliban commanders with tens of thousands of dollars to fund their operations and disbursed funds directly to Taliban shadow governors. Hafiz Mohammed Popalzai is one of four individuals responsible for all Taliban financing, including foreign financing and money from the narcotics trade. He also invests the Taliban's money. Malawi Inayatullah has operated as the overall Taliban member responsible for attacks against Afghan and coalition forces in Kabul and provided financial support and other materials for the attack planners. Fakir Mohammed has for many years been a major fundraiser for the Haqqani Network. Gula Khan Hamidi facilitated communications between a Haqqani Network official and a Haqqani Network contact in Syria. He also facilitated the transfer of funds from the Haqqani Network to Haqqani-affiliated extremists. We are targeting six individuals related to the Taliban or Haqqani Network who have been involved in attacks on coalition troops, smuggling of individuals, or financing of these terrorist groups, said Sigal Mandelker, Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence. This action supports the President's South Asia strategy by disrupting these terrorist organizations and publicly exposing individuals who facilitate their activities. The Pakistani government must work with us to deny the Taliban and the Haqqani Network sanctuary and to aggressively target their terrorist funding.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.